Hello, everybody, and welcome to Elmtown episode 26. Today, we're going to be talking about Swedish and Norwegian news with Noah Hall. First, we have our sponsors, though, Day One, which is the company that I work for. We make a beautiful journaling and life archiving Mac app for Mac and iOS and Android, and working on web as well. So we try to make it a gorgeous experience and a pleasant way to keep track of your journal. And, you know, some people have realized that it's kind of like social media. It's kind of like writing social media posts, but without anyone else seeing. It's just for yourself and just for your personal self and those who you show it to. So you can be a little, maybe a little more candid than you might be on social media. So that's a nice way to keep track of your own life. I love it, and I hope you will too. Daily Drip, next up, makes keeping up to date on programming skills easy. Daily Drip will save you a ton of time by providing quality lessons and resources for you right off the bat. Some of the topics that they offer include Elixir, Crystal, React Native, Go, HTML, and of course, Elm. Learn faster and more efficiently with Daily Drip and be a better developer. Every weekday, you'll get a short video about 5 minutes or so delivered to your inbox. You can sign up at dailydrip.com and use the coupon code ELMTOWN, all lowercase, all one word, ELMTOWN-2018, which is 2018, and you'll get a 14-day free trial, and we will get accolades and recognition from them, and they may want to keep sponsoring, which is great. Next is Futurus, which is a company that we love, a new breed of innovation consultancy with digital values at its core. They believe in happy people, happy customers, and happy users. They're Elm users, they're community contributors, and they're innovators in the open source space. They hire good people, and they do good work, and they sponsor us, and we are really appreciative to them for that. Last but not least is Ellie, which is the Elm Live editor that we can use to help push the development of Elm forward and help our own projects too. Ellie is available for anyone to use free of charge. You can go ahead and write Elm code online, compile it straight in your browser, and it's great for doing things like sample code, great for getting help on the Elm Slack, etc. So big thanks to Ellie for being there and also for supporting this podcast. And I want to send out a big thank you to Fergus Meeklejohn for producing and editing our episodes. That is extremely helpful. Thank you very much, Fergus. I'm going to excuse myself again because there's still construction going on next door. My mic setup is hopefully pretty good, so I don't think you'll hear a ton of it. But just in case, I'm sorry beforehand. But now, with no further ado, let's get to the important part of the podcast and introduce Noah.
Hello, I'm Noah.
Noah. You've been on the podcast before, but I think it's been about a year. So why don't you tell listeners and me where you are, what you're doing, and what you have been offering to the community for the past while.
So I'm Noah. You might know me as EUE56.
Do you want to explain that, by the way? I saw an explanation on Twitter, and might be a cool explanation for people to hear.
Yeah, so the noise I just made, EUE56, it's my university ID from when I was at university, and I was at the School of Electronic Engineering, so that's EE, and I was an undergraduate, so that's the U, and then the last part was a hex code of something, so I guess whatever E56 in decimal is, that was my student ID for that year.
This was actually assigned to you. This wasn't one you picked. That was just like your student ID.
I'm a big fan of random selection choosing my life decisions for me. So it's pretty much it. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Okay. So Noah and EUE56. I just always say EUE56 and I don't even say it. I just see it in my mind. So that's great. So you are living in the European region of the world, is that correct?
Yes, I am living in Oslo right now in Norway.
Very cool. And you are working on some very interesting news apps that's going to be the topic of conversation today. And so you posted about this on the new Elm Discuss channel, and you said, hey, look, we made this really cool thing. It's server-side rendered, etc. But, you know, I'm not doing a very good job of describing it. All I know is that we wanted to make an Elmtown podcast on it because it's pretty neat. So before I make any weird spoilers, why don't you tell us what the two apps are that we're going to be talking about?
So it's actually three apps, but three. Two of the main ones. So I work for a company called Shipstead, and within Shipstead, I work for a smaller company called Omni. Omni is a news application intended for people who really like news. So like people who just have to read all the news all the time. And one of the core features of Omni is that it has an application and a lot of like a mobile application. And that's where the focus of the product is. So most of the users use the phone application rather than the website. Another aspect is that a lot of the news is, I've forgotten the word, but it's aggregate news where they take news from other news sources and they write it up in such a way that it's pretty simple to read and only like two or three paragraphs with some images and four or five different sources. So you can read more about a given news story if you want to without needing to go too in-depth.
Is that called syndicated news? I might be wrong about that.
There's a word that we use, and I can't remember what the news is, the word is. But syndicated doesn't sound right to me, but maybe it is.
But your description was completely sufficient. That makes a lot of sense. So that's really cool. So you have your own editors. So why are there three apps and not just one app?
So Omni started as this one product for Swedish news, focusing on everything. Politics, economics, sports, tech, local news, foreign news. And then at some point it was decided that the platform that was made to support Omni was pretty cool and pretty powerful. And so in Norway, there was a company called E24. And they are like economic news written in Norwegian, but they cover the whole world, basically. And their priority is focusing on delivering news first. So whenever a big news story breaks about like Google or Tesla, E24 is usually the first, or quite often the first, to report on a news story. Sometimes in the world, sometimes just in Norway, sometimes not, but can't have everything.
Right.
So
you made a version for them?
Yeah. So we just, the version we made for them is called Min E24, which is like My Economy News 24 or whatever.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
And that right now is just the mobile app. They have an existing E24 news site, but the Min version that we made is kind of the mobile application, and it has a different set of editors and reports on slightly different news from the old E24 news site.
Okay, so then what about the third one before I get into other questions?
And the third one is called Omni Economy, and that one is kind of like E24, but in Sweden. So the Omni team, they were finding that they were writing about economic news a lot, I guess. And so they decided that they should spin out another product called Omni Economy, which focused just on news.
On news about the economy.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so this is cool. So these are different apps. Now, how is Elm involved in these apps? Are they on the mobile side at all, or is it all just web companionship?
So one of the things about being a mobile news app is that you need a way for people who don't have your app installed to view the news that people share on Facebook or Reddit or other places where they might want people to read the news that they just read without needing to install the app. So what we did was make something called a web share. And basically there's a button inside these apps, and you click on that button. And when you click on it, it gives you a link, and that link will open in a web page.
Okay. Does that generate a new share every time, or does it just reuse the same share for the existing article kind of thing?
For a given article, it's always the same URL. Yeah.
Okay. So there might be some generation cost the first time a user shares an article, but after that, other users will reshare that same thing?
Yeah. Yeah. Right, I see what you're asking.
And caching.
Yeah, like caching. Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
Very cool. So that's the Elm part. So there's no Elm in the apps themselves, right?
No, none in the Elm apps themselves, and none on the backend. Just for the web share right now.
So then, tell us about the web share when you came up to this requirement. Like, what were some of your considerations in requirements for the web share as far as the product needs to behave in X manner? And also, why did you choose Elm versus some other technology for that?
Good question. So the main concerns that we had for making a web share is it needs to be as lightweight as possible and super fast. It needs to basically never break, so that if there is a big news article breaking, like, for example, man lands on Mars or alien comes to visit Kenya or something like that.
Yeah, this would be pretty big. Yeah.
Pretty big, I think. I hope. Then we want the website to be able to always be up. We don't want it to go down and say, sorry, you can't read about this amazing or terrible thing that happened because our backend was bad.
Right, yeah.
And so Elm fits into those requirements kind of well. So it fits into the never breaking requirement pretty well because you can't really have runtime exceptions. It fits into the fast criteria if you consider rendering speed, but it's not so fast if you consider download size, bandwidth that you need to load a page if you're using Elm in the browser is pretty expensive right now.
At least for right now, yeah.
Yeah. We have to prefix everything like that with like right now. Like one thing isn't right about Elm, and then end it with like right now.
Right. Yes. Not forever.
Not forever. Soon fixed. So
that's interesting that you went with Elm anyway, regardless of that that cost, or did you get around it somehow?
So we got around it somehow. And the way we got around that was through server-side rendering the Elm and sending down a tiny, tiny amount of HTML to the web client. That means that the web pages themselves load almost instantaneously. And we could also cache the generated HTML so that if our backend ever did go down, we can just send that HTML out so that it will always work no matter what.
Wow. So is there any Elm that actually gets shipped to the front end at all? Or is it just basically being used as a templating language right now?
Right now, there's no Elm being shipped to the front end at all.
Wow. So that's really interesting. So you made the choice for Elm for its stability in a language structure, not so much for the interactive application aspect of it.
Right, exactly. We have to work with this. We have a backend which has to be fairly flexible because it's consumed by several front-end clients. For example, the Android and iOS apps have different applications. They're not the same code base. There's some other things like newsletters and web APIs that consume the same stuff. And that API is all JSON. And JSON decoders in Elm make it really easy to do basically no work and get a lot of free safety and free guidance on what to do. So it fit pretty perfectly just for matching the API that we have.
Oh man, yeah, I love JSON decoders. So tell me then more about server-side rendering, because that's also one of those things that isn't mainstream in Elm right now, right?
Right. It might be in the future, but right now it's definitely not. And server-side rendering in Elm is kind of an interesting topic because what people consider to be server-side rendering can be multiple things. They might consider just turning Elm into HTML on the servers, server-side rendering, which is like literally what server-side rendering means. But they usually mean like hydration. So after you send the initial generated HTML down to the client, then people usually want the ability to also send the Elm runtime down. And when the Elm runtime is finished downloading, take over the page with the Elm runtime again.
You didn't have to worry about that for this project, right?
For this project, I didn't have to worry about that at all. But I know that some people have done that with the library that I made for server-side rendering. But I mostly only cared about templating and avoiding not really caring about sending any interactive stuff down at all.
But just for this project, when you were doing the library before, you did consider those things, it sounds like.
Yeah, I did consider them, but it hasn't been a major focus for me personally.
What's the name of the library?
So the one that I used in this project is called Elm Static HTML Lib, and it's a TypeScript package that you can get on NPM, and you just give it like a view and maybe a decoder if you want and a model, and then it will just generate the HTML based on that view and that decoder and that model.
So is this using the Elm compiler in the background?
What it does is run Elm make and then use ports to send in the model that you gave it to the decoder. And then that decoded thing will end up in the view. And then the function is HTML and sent back.
So the actual implementation of this requires Node.js, right?
Yes. It requires JS. Did you say Node.js or JS?
Yes, or just some runtime. Just it doesn't matter if it's Node specifically.
It requires some JavaScript.
I mean, could you run it in some JVM JavaScript environment interpreter, or is it just like, yeah, just use Node and like fork out? You know, if your server is written in Scala or something, just go ahead and like use Node in a different process if you're going to do server side rendering. Is that how you would? So gotcha. We should do this, or
yeah.
How do you guys do it?
So
you all.
We just have an Express server written in Node in TypeScript, and then it just calls it as a library. But I do know of some people who are using this kind of stuff with Java, and what they use is Rhino, I think, which is like the JavaScript interpreter for Java.
Oh, that's really interesting. So did they have to get a virtual DOM library in there to make that work, or is that something you included in the library yourself?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question and an interesting story. So the way that this library came about was that in 0.15 in Elm, then we needed a way to test the views that we had. And they used to be really easy to do it that back then, because Elm used to use a standard virtual DOM implementation in JavaScript, which is just called virtual DOM, like as virtual DOM, a name you could get. And for that library, someone had made a server-side renderer function. So you would just pass the virtual DOM of that state to this library function, and it would give you back the HTML. But with 0.17, I guess, the virtual DOM was completely rewritten to be Elm specific. So it could no longer use that library and get server-side rendering for free. Instead, now we had to rewrite our own. And we were using this, we were using the server-side rendering stuff at Node Inc. for testing our views a lot. So when 0.17 was in alpha, I wrote a basic server-side renderer for Elm, which would take the new Elm data structures and turn them into HTML strings. And the way it did that would be by taking the current virtual DOM object, the Elm virtual DOM object, and parsing through the whole tree and turning it into a standard union type in Elm, which would look like type node with the tag name and various properties and children. It could be a text node, which was just text contained within. It could be a custom thing like Markdown or WebGL. So then we basically had a union type that would truly represent the Elm virtual DOM. And then from there, just converting that union type into string was pretty trivial, like 200 lines total or something.
So that's all written in Elm. That's like...
Yeah, so there's actually
Elm HTML.
Like the only JavaScript required was the JavaScript to turn the Elm runtime virtual DOM object into a JSON object that we can parse and walk through.
So that's interesting. So it goes from Elm to the JavaScript representation of the Elm virtual DOM back to an Elm union type to be stringified. Is that right? Did I understand it correctly?
That's kind of. So like the Elm virtual DOM, just to clarify, the Elm virtual DOM representation is in JavaScript right now. So if you're using like Elm HTML, then that is actually a JavaScript implementation, but specifically written for Elm.
Yeah.
So what we have is something that will take that representation and turn it into a Elm representation of that JavaScript representation of the virtual DOM.
Okay, so you like pass that into a port or something and say like, here's my VDOM JavaScript object. I'm sorry, I don't need to go into all the details, but I am quite curious as to how that works. So you actually do the conversion from the Elm virtual DOM into a string in Elm, not in JavaScript land.
Exactly, yeah. So there is possible to do it in JavaScript. And in theory, that is faster, but I wanted it to be safer.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So the majority of the server-side rendering implementation that I have in Elm is mostly decoders to handle all the different possible states. For example, if you have a lazy view, then that has to be decoded in a different way. Or if you have a keyed view, that also has to be decoded in a different way. And the majority of the rest is pretty trivial.
That's really interesting. So you have to update that library now only when the virtual DOM representation updates. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that seems more or less pretty stable at this point.
It's pretty stable. And it also helps us to catch virtual DOM bugs because that library is actually being used in Elm HTML test, which allows you to test your HTML views. And that allows us to have some kind of like assurances on how the virtual DOM works and how it's represented.
Wow, that is really interesting. So that's all stuff you did while you were at No Red Ink, and you're able to take advantage of that now at your new gig too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wow. So then tell me how it's been going. Like, you've released this product and you've got to see it in the wild. Do you have any stats about how many people are using it? Do you have any information about how hard it's been to maintain? Has it been as robust as you wanted, etc.?
So I don't think I can give any numbers on users. But what I can say is that if you look at the top charts for Sweden and Norway for iOS and Google Play, then since we released both products, then they've mostly stayed in the top 8 or so.
Wow, that's awesome.
Which is pretty a top 8 for news, to clarify. Not total.
Okay, not in the whole App Store. Okay.
But that's still pretty impressive because that means they are beating things like Twitter or Reddit or the existing alternatives to our news products that exist. So they're doing pretty well, I'd say.
Yeah, that's awesome. Have you gotten a lot of reports of like, oh man, this didn't end up turning out how you'd hoped, you got to go do a bunch of bug fixes? Or has it been pretty stable?
It's been pretty stable, mostly because of what we released has been matching existing products, matching the existing Omni news app, for example.
Okay.
So most of our backend stuff, we've mostly been focusing on scaling up rather than bug fixes.
That's awesome. So what about like lessons learned along the way? If you were to go back and start this project over again, what would you do differently? Or what would you say like, yeah, my biggest thing that I learned from doing this project is X?
So I learned a couple of things. One of the really exciting things that I learned is that server-side rendering with Elm is super fast. Even though I'm doing it the slow way of turning it into a JSON object and then parsing that JSON object, the response times for the web share thing, the actual Elm part of it takes 10 milliseconds.
Wow, that's awesome.
So,
and that's just that's the first part, right? Like that's the generation, the first time the article is generated, and then after that, it's just cached.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. So our sieve is like doing 10 milliseconds of work whenever a new article has
that's
to be rendered.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I was very happy about that. Actually, I was expecting it to be pretty slow because the approach is kind of, it's not designed for speed, but it just is fast. It just works. It just is quick. And that feels really good to know.
Love that. Would you have done anything differently the second time around if you had gone back to do it again?
I'm not sure. So one interesting thing that we did is because the web share has to support three different clones, then I use a union type with Elm CSS to represent the different clones that we're building for. And each one has very subtle differences. So we might have like an Omni Economy clone, which has a title in a certain place. And we might have our E24 clone with the title in a different place. And that's mostly worked out okay. But the Elm CSS for it is pretty unreadable.
Because of just the complexity.
Yeah, so imagine you have like a padding function and you want to give it a different pixel size based on the clone that you have. So the way I do it right now is I have padding and then I do a case of over all the clones, and then I have to say case of Omni Economy, then make it 12 pixels, or A24, make it 13 pixels.
That's pretty rough.
Yeah, there's pros and cons because it allows you to ensure that all your different products are covered when you add a new feature, a new CSS style. I'm never going to forget that I need to make Omni Economy have padding, for example, if I add A24. But it is a lot of boilerplate to maintain.
I'm curious to know why you didn't do something like just have a different template for each product and you just switch and say like, oh, here's the view function for Omni Economy versus E24, for example.
The main reason was because the bulk of the rendering is identical. The main difference is the styling. And I think for the styling part, then I probably in the future would have done something like that where maybe I had like generalized styles. And then I could specify overrides per clone. For example, I might say that the standard padding to have is 12 pixels. And then I might do some kind of overriding where I can say, yeah, but E24 should have 24 pixels of padding.
Oh, that makes sense, yeah.
So then for each clone, you only have to maintain the differences rather than maintain the similarities kind of.
Yeah, right. Isn't it interesting how much of our time is affected by data modeling decisions? Like that seems to be one of the most crucial skills to get right or to get experienced in, is just understanding what's going to be a good data model or being comfortable with backing out and switching it, you know, when it seems to be not the right decision anymore. At least that's what I've experienced for my code too.
Yeah, completely. Data modeling. A great example of that was we had this text element, and initially I didn't support any kind of markup styling on that text element. So it would just render like a bold thing as plain text. But in our API, we actually define markup as like an additional rules that come down with some text. And so I had to completely change how I modeled the text. And I spent maybe like an hour just inside the terminal, just like hitting command B every time I needed to recompile and check that it was working. And by the end of that time, when I'd finally finished, like, okay, now I need to represent something that is bold and a list and something which should be italic. And when I came out the end, then it just worked and it was fine. And once I
love that, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's a good feeling with Elm.
Definitely. You know, actually, that's a good point, is that if data modeling is one of the most important things to get right, or to have to change, one of the hardest things to change, it's cool that that's also one of the areas where Elm gives you the most safety too. And actually, I thought that that would be an interesting demo. We were talking about what would be good demos for meetups, and we thought maybe a good demo for a JavaScript meetup where you're introducing Elm is, instead of the normal old, like, this is what Elm syntax looks like, instead if you had something where you said, like, well, look, here's my small project that I've made, and then the product manager comes along and says, we have to make this change that requires like a fundamental data model change. And then you just follow the compiler, like you make that change and then follow the compiler messages and then watch it just work when you reload the application. And I thought that would be a pretty neat demo, because that's what as JavaScript developers, application developers, that's like one of the scariest things, is when the business requirement comes in and says, by the way, you've gotten your model wrong, you need to change it. Because then you go, oh, that's everywhere all throughout my code, you know?
Yeah. And a great example of that, actually, for the main Omni website, which is still written in JavaScript, I refactored it before Christmas to use our new API. And we changed from having like a title, which was just .title, to .title.value, because we had some extra metadata about the title inside an object. And so everywhere I needed to do like a find and replace of .title and replace it with title.value. And when we deployed that, I was like, okay, I'm not sure if that's going to break. I think it will break. And so I had to spend a whole bunch of time writing these, web UI tests, because I couldn't ever be sure that I didn't forget it in one place, or if in one place it shouldn't have been .title.value, it should have just been .title. Whereas when I need to make those changes in the web share, I can just do it trivially and just be like, okay, it works. I can go to lunch. I don't have to sit here and watch to see if users start complaining.
Oh, I love that. One of the most exciting parts of Elm, I think. Well, that is awesome. Did you have anything else to add before we wrap up and get to the end about the products, or about what your experience with them?
Generally, I'd say it's been great and they've really worked really well. And hopefully we'll be introducing Elm to more places.
Excellent. Love it. Okay. Well, do you have any picks, any pick links?
Yeah. So if you haven't seen it already, I recommend going to check out the Elm Discourse, which is the replacement for Elm Discuss. We set that up 2 months ago, I guess. I guess Brian set it up initially 2 months ago. But
yeah, it's a much better experience. Very neat.
Way better than Google Groups. And you can have real discussions on there. And it doesn't feel as spammy as Reddit, if that's kind to say, I guess.
and it has good tools for code and pasting in, you know, snippets. And I think Ellie is embeddable as well there too, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah, and people have really taken to it, and there's already a bunch of really good, interesting discussions that previously I felt like I couldn't really take part in Google Groups because I didn't quite feel right about using it for some reason. But Discourse, so far, a lot better.
Agreed. Awesome. Got that in there. Anything else?
I think that's probably it off the top of my head, because I can't think of... I guess I have one recommendation, that if you are writing modern JavaScript still and you are stuck with a JavaScript family language, then I can really highly recommend TypeScript. The tooling for it is pretty phenomenal. It's kind of like having a powerful IDE in Sublime Text, if you use Sublime Text. So I can imagine like VS Code is incredible, since that's written in TypeScript. And it's been a really enjoyable experience. The type system is interesting, but easier to get to grips with than others, I think. And it's got everything that you might want from Elm, for example. Not quite everything, but in terms of tooling, that it has like a TS format which will automatically format your code like Elm Format does. And it has compiler errors that will give you good warnings. It's generally very good.
Excellent. Yeah, TypeScript is a really neat project. And I'll pick an alternative to TypeScript, which is a more functional-based alternative, which is ReasonML, which I may have talked about in the past. But ReasonML is, I mean, all those things you talked about with TypeScript are also coming along in Reason, which is a new syntax for OCaml, which can be compiled to nice readable JavaScript too. So it is by no means the only functional alternative to TypeScript for writing JS. There are many others too. But I've been liking it recently, and I will drop a little hint-a-reno on here that Reason Town might be a thing coming up in future months. So if you keep your, if you're interested, you can keep your ears peeled and see if that comes along. So there's one. And the other one I'm going to pick is Elm CSS, the good old Elm CSS library that I had the pleasure of recording a podcast with Richard about last week. And that'll be released obviously before you hear this one. But I hadn't looked at Elm CSS in quite a while when I recorded that show with him, and it had some major and majorly awesome upgrades to it. So I'm going to pick Elm CSS because it's super cool. So there are my picks. Any last comments, Noah?
Thank you for having me.
You are so welcome. Anytime. We love having you on. And thanks for all of the work you do for the community too, moderating and offering your work and your contributions. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Likewise.
Thanks everybody for listening.
Bye.